the government coming? We need gasoline. With gasoline, you're going to bring food and gasoline and clothes? And gasoline to run generators. Bring us generators. Bring us something to get heat. We're going to die if we get killed with the weather. We're going to die. We're going to freeze. We have no cars. President Obama, please listen to us down here. We are going to die. You don't understand. You've got to get your trucks here on this corner.
Buckle your seatbelt. It's time for another episode of the Prepper Recon Podcast.
KatieArmor.com is your one-stop shop for the most affordable body armor, period. With packages starting at $169.99 and free shipping on every order. Katie offers soft armor and rifle threat rated armor up to level 4. Go to KatieArmor.com and get your body armor today while you still can. Mention this ad and receive a free tactical scarf for a limited time with any body armor package. That's CatiArmor.com.
All long-term storage food is not created equal. Folks who have been prepping for a while will tell you there's a long-term storage food that you can eat if you have to, and long-term storage food that you love to eat. The apocalypse will be tough enough. Buy high-quality foods that you'll love to eat from Valley Food Storage at valleyfoodstorage.com. Today's guest is Tim Young from selfsufficientman.com. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. Super, super glad to be here.
Oh, absolutely. It's an honor to have you on. Now, when did you first wake up to the need to prepare?
Oh, well, I think I went to sleep for a few decades. Actually, I was awake when I was a kid. I mean, I grew up in the North Georgia mountains, hunting, fishing, and doing most things that people did back then, and then went away to corporate America for a few decades and kind of got lost in the business world. I think I woke up, I'd say around 2005, 2006, when I was living north of Atlanta. We were just, living in a typical suburban community, living on a golf course, and I had a corporate background. My wife was a teacher by background. And, we started reading some of the books that were popular about 10 years ago from, Michael Pollan, think like The Omnivore's Dilemma, or some books by Barbara Kingsolver. And we just became aware slowly of how unaware we were of where our food came from. And started looking around and saying, we go out for everything. And as that realization hit us, rather than doing something, irrational, like going to a farmer's market, we did something irrational and bought 126 acres of farmland and just upped and moved out to the country for the first time, to become farmers. And, we just jumped headfirst into trying, to develop a sustainable farming operation and started producing grass-fed beef and pasture-raised pork and chicken and selling them directly to customers in the Atlanta market, and did that for a number of years and really, really enjoyed it, but ultimately wanted to really be homesteaders at heart and self-sufficient more than to be farmers for a large market, if you know what I mean. So we went down the path and ultimately became cheesemakers making raw milk cheese, and that kind of brings us to where we are today. We're living out there off the land, very, very self-sufficient, taking care of ourselves, but have also found ways to earn an income, while doing it.
Wow! So you just jumped right into it, and you just you didn't wade in through the shallow end. You just walked over the deep end and said, "I don't know if it's cold or hot. I'm just jumping in."
Yeah, I think one of the good things I had going for me, and one of the very bad things at the same time, is my background is an entrepreneur, and I came from I had a marketing services business prior to this, and a lot of entrepreneurs, they're not really afraid to do things. They will just jump in, and we totally jumped in, and so, we'll go learn how to farm. How hard can it be? And the truth is, farming is hard work, and it's all the things that you hear about it. But at the same time, it's pretty basic fundamental things that we as humankind have known how to do for a long time. And for some reason, we've become kind of afraid as people that we can't do these things. We can't plant seeds. We can't raise livestock or butcher animals or make our own soaps or bacon or whatever it may be. We had the courage to dive in, and we figured out a lot of things, and we were fortunate that there's a burgeoning market out there. There was then, and there still is today, that is looking to support people who want to farm what I call, sustainably, ethically, humanely. And there's a lot of support out there for that. From our point of view, we wanted to reach that market, but what we really aspired towards was self-reliance. We didn't know the word prepper at the time, to be honest with you, Mark. We just kind of knew that we wanted to be less dependent on the system and be more self-reliant on ourselves.
And it's when you just say that you jumped in, it sounds like it, you know, you just sold the house and bought a farm and it already had chickens and animals and everything on it. But it must be a little bit longer process than that. Can you get a little more in depth into what the process was to move the rural area and start your homestead?
Yeah, absolutely. And it actually wasn't nearly as good as what you said. I retold this entire story in a book called The Accidental Farmers, if anybody ever wants to go out and grab a copy and read that. But we actually bought raw land. It wasn't a farm. It had nothing on it. In fact, it was overgrown pastures. There was a creek that went back to the home site, and there was no way across the creek, so we had to drive our truck down into the creek and figure out our way to get through to the pastures. We had to build a house. We had to put in almost a 4,000-foot driveway. We had to drill wells. I mean, you know, run power lines. I mean, the whole deal to set up a place to live on this piece of land. Then we had to fence. I think it was 15,000 feet of fence, you know, that we did to fence in this farm to raise all the animals that we raised. And, you know, raised them for many years before we ultimately morphed the farm into a raw milk cheese operation. And the reason we did that is, you know, we have a young daughter now, 3 years old. And when we knew that that was going to happen for us, we decided that we wanted the farm to be about maximizing our time with her. So those other operations took a little bit more time than the cheese operation, and so we focused on the cheese. But, the process was, you know, we sold our house in Atlanta. We looked for a piece of land. Our criteria were, you know, mainly to be within 3 hours of Atlanta so we could get back for ball games and concerts and stuff. I mean, it was very naive. We thought we'd want to get back to the city for some reason. And, you know, we never, ever, ever go back to the city at this point. I mean, it's, you know, it's a ridiculous thought that we'd want to get back there. But when we lived there, we thought that, well, we're going to miss these things. We're going to miss the convenience and the entertainment and the arts and the culture. We're going to want to come back and see that. And it's just, you know, ridiculous. You don't want to go back and see that once you get out to the land. But that was a criterion, so we found that location, and then we cleared the land, built the house, and got the animals. Read a bunch of books by great farmers, you know, like Joel Salatin as an example, and you know, learned some tricks of the trade and just started farming. That was it.
That's fantastic. And now you've written several books, but you've got a new one that just came out. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, the last book, I wrote two in the last month that came out. Start Prepping is the one that's about preparedness. And, you know, the origin of that book, a number of my books were kind of accidental. I mean, I was starting the writing process and said, what do I really want to share with people? And I've read some really great books about preparedness out there. But there's a lot of doom and gloom mindset in the world of prepping. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, of course, we all know the phrase doomsday preppers. I kind of refer to us, whatever the opposite of that is. If it's sunshine preppers, that's what we are. And what I mean by that is we don't believe that something is necessarily imminently going to happen tomorrow. I never go to someone and say, look out for the CME or the solar flare or the EMP tomorrow or the super volcano. This is going to happen. You better be ready. Rather, you know, our perspective is more like, look, it's just absolutely prudent to be prepared. I mean, it makes no sense to not be prepared. I mean, people already do things to prepare and they don't think about it. I mean, they carry spare tires in their car. They have life insurance policies. They have savings accounts. They keep a plunger by the toilet. They go to the dentist to, you know, get their teeth checked on. They keep a diaper bag if they go out with a baby. I mean, these are all other ways of viewing prepping. And what I wanted to do was write a book that walks people through, you know, ways to prepare that makes sense for common sense for people who aren't interested in necessarily putting in a bunker and loading it up with ammo, but rather being prepared for everyday events. And that's what Start Prepping was designed to do.
In the first chapter of Start Prepping is called Land of the Free and Home of the Unprepared. Do you think our nation is getting soft?
I don't know if the nation, from a military point of view, is the nation getting soft? You know,
Individually, you know, yeah, we don't. Yeah, a lot of people are just, they're at the level to where, you know, they can barely tie their shoes.
Well, let me say this. I mean, I have a, like I just said, I have a young daughter. She's 3 years old. So 3 years ago, she was an infant. And infants are completely dependent on their parents. Without their parents, they cannot live. As citizens, it's my view that we're 100% dependent. Food comes from someone else. Electricity comes from, no one knows where electricity comes from, but it comes from a utility company. Healthcare comes from doctors. Job comes from an employer, if you're lucky, because people don't know how to employ themselves for the most part. We can't build our own houses. We don't mow our own lawns. We don't know how to change the oil in our cars. We certainly can't sew. So we don't know how to do anything. I mean, very few people have gardens. Some people do, but very few do as a percentage. No one saves seeds. No one knows how to build shelters. No one knows how to preserve food, reload ammunition. They can't butcher animals. No one knows how to make their own soaps or medicine. I mean, these are things that I grew up and my grandmother knew how to do all these things, and we did these things. But today, our society, we rely on the dollar and Walmart for everything. Now, that's fine because, look, I mean, if you look around you, I mean, people are happy and content, and people are driving their cars right now as they're listening to your podcast and saying, you know, that's fine. It is fine, but it's perilous because you're 100% dependent on the system for everything. If that system, for whatever reason, breaks down, then imagine the number of people, the tens and tens and tens of millions of people who all of a sudden are going to be desperate. They don't have 3 days worth of food. They certainly don't have 3 days worth of water. They have no ability to source water, to purify water. They don't know how to start a fire. They don't know how to clothe themselves. I mean, they can't do any of these kind of things. We as a nation have very short-term memories, you know, so we don't think things really will happen. We're aware because of books that the depression happened, but we don't think financial collapse can happen, civil unrest can happen, pandemics can happen, a solar flare. That's something that's like science fiction. These are society-threatening disasters that, you know, history tells us absolutely can happen and will happen, but people don't believe that they will happen to them in their lifetime. So we're obsessed with, you know, the odds. Well, what are the odds that, you know, a Carrington type, you know, CME is going to happen. And, it doesn't sound that good, so I'm not going to worry about it. But we don't calculate the risk we're taking with our lives. You know what I mean? When we think about those odds, we don't then finish a sentence. I don't think the odds of a CME are that great, so therefore I'm willing to risk my daughter's life. We don't finish a sentence that way. If we did, we'd say, wait a minute, that's ridiculous. I probably should be more prepared. You know, and the studies that are out there show that we are afraid. Every time there's a natural disaster, there's all these studies that show that people know they should be doing more. We expect more violence as a nation. We expect more civil unrest. But we don't prepare because we live in the moment and we live in make-believe. You know, we live where there's instant everything. We stress out if we can't get a phone signal. We have no patience in front of a microwave. We're obsessed with The Walking Dead, and we're obsessed with any TV show about Alaska, but we never stop and mimic the survival mindset that those shows show you. So, yeah, is our nation soft? I mean, well, you tell me.
Yeah, I think so, about like a marshmallow. Now,
I don't think we're ready for anything.
No. You broke preparedness down into 10 basic steps in Start Prepping. Can you go through those for us?
Yeah, I think you see these kind of things, you know, often you'll hear people, you know, talk about the steps of preparedness, and you always hear people talk about, you know, food storage and water and all that. You know, I wanted to think about what I thought the individual steps were and what the prioritization of those steps were. And I actually prioritized food as number three. And, you know, I said in the book, look, there's a lot of things that come before food. Water was number one. I mean, in pure survival, you know, air is going to be number one, but I assume we're going to have air. But what I really talked about in the water chapter was, you know, the steps for being able to source water. You know, can you drink the water from your swimming pool or from your waterbed or from your water heater? And if so, how do you do it? How do you purify water? The second step, which comes before food, is shelter, warmth, and comfort. Because if you don't have the ability to be sheltered both from the elements, but also from bad guys that are out there, if it's riots or looting or even from animals, then you're not going to make it to the point of food. So a lot of discussion about shelter, warmth, and comfort. And then food, of course, there's five different phases of food storage that I talked about and how to do that and what you should do. Specifically, created a 14-day menu because the whole premise of this book wasn't to get someone prepared for long-term, which, by the way, Mark, of course, I agree that people should aspire towards. This book was all about to show them specifically how to prepare for short-term disasters, 14 to 30 days, because that's the most I thought I could get out of most people. So that chapter included a 14-day menu. Do this exactly, you'll be prepared for 14 days. But it also dispelled some of the myths out there about expiration dates and food that I know people worry about. The next step was energy, and I talked a lot about when to use a generator, when to use an inverter, how to produce your own energy. And then I got to what I think is the two most important chapters of the book, and this is sanitation and medical. And I think I said in the book that, you know, if you've ever got a grid down scenario, people are going to be far more worried about where to go to the bathroom than they are what to eat. And I don't think people really have thought at all about, well, what happens if the electricity isn't working? Now, if you've got your own septic system, you're out on a farm, you should be okay. But most people rely on sewers, which rely on electricity. And there's going to be some big problems for people to deal with there. The chapter that I do think was the most important in the book was the next one, the next step, which is security and the survival mindset. And actually, it's such an important part of the book that I actually created a spinoff book that's coming out later this month called The Survival Mindset. Because I'm just appalled at the lack of situational awareness that we all show when we're out and about. And when you look at the number of theater shootings and school shootings and church shootings, and, you know, it's happening everywhere. And these are good times, Mark. I mean, you and I could debate whether politically this nation's going in a good direction or whatever. But, you know, the fact is right now things are pretty stable for people. What happens when times aren't good? Right now, times are pretty stable and good, and we have significant violence out there that people are unprepared for. So the longest chapter in the book was about security and the survival mindset. The next step after that was money and documents, how to be prepared for disasters, and had no mention, believe it or not, of gold or silver or precious metals. There's no encouragement in there whatsoever to get someone to invest in precious metals, not because I don't believe that real assets are important, but because the purpose of this book was to be prepared for 14 to, you know, days to a month. And I don't really believe that precious metals is likely to help them in that situation. And, you know, the next step was travel security. And, you know, for example, as I'm talking to you now, I'm 5 hours from home. And we took a trip to see our parents, you know, down some very back country roads. And this whole chapter breaks down, in addition to evacuation plans, and you might have to leave your home or to bug out, normal travel, when you go somewhere, what do you do when you have typical emergencies? And, you know, you're in the middle of nowhere, you pull over on the side of the road, and, you know, a couple guys pull up and they want to help you. You know, do you know what to say? Are you prepared if you don't want the help, but they want to insist? So there's a lot of these little things that I put into the umbrella of preparedness that we don't always think about as preparedness, you know, because preparedness means bullets and beans and band-aids to most people. But all these things mean preparedness. And the last two steps are communication, how you're going to communicate with people, and skills. What skills do you need to be better equipped to take care of yourself and be prepared?
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. I've personally been buying gold and silver from JM Bullion for over 2 years. They offer the best prices over spot that I can find, and I've never had a problem with an order. If you're looking to trade in some of your fiat paper for real money, check out jmbullion.com today.
When disaster strikes, it's too late to prepare. PrepperRecon.com offers MOLLE-compatible individual first aid kits for your home, auto, or bug-out bag. These kits have everything you need to address a traumatic injury, including an Israeli battle dressing, quick clot, EMT shears, suture kit, Steri-Strips, tourniquet, ACS chest seal, tough strip bandages, gauze, and so much more. $89 includes shipping. To buy your individual first aid kit, go to PrepperRecon.com and click the store tab at the top of the homepage. Order today before it's too late.
You make cheese. You were talking about that a little bit earlier. Can you just give us the basics behind making cheese?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, right? Because when I first made cheese for the first time, and I've done many classes on teaching people to make cheese, it's like one of these things that we don't believe we can do, right? It's mystical. It's magic. I mean, it's just milk. You know, and the way I thought about cheese when I first learned to make it was, well, people made cheese, you know, hundreds of years ago. I mean, you know, thousands of years ago. You know, how did they do it? And they may not have understood the science to the degree that we do. But cheese basically is, you know, heat the milk up if you're starting with cold milk. Otherwise, if it's coming right out of the sheep or the goat or the cow, you know, then actually let it cool down a little bit. But when you get it to the right temperature, which is normally going to be, you know, 88, 90 degrees, you're going to add starter culture. And the starter culture is just bacteria that's friendly bacteria. And the reason you do that is if you didn't add the starter culture, there's already a lot of bacteria in the milk, particularly in raw milk. And some of that bacteria is harmful bacteria. Well, what all the bacteria like to do is feed on the lactose, which is the milk sugar. When you add friendly bacteria to the milk, what it's going to do is start very aggressively consuming that lactose, and then it excretes lactic acid. So that causes the pH in the milk to drop. But since it so aggressively consumes that lactose, it doesn't give the bad bacteria any chance to get a toehold, if you will, so the bad bacteria just dies off. So you use the friendly bacteria to produce the lactic acid, and then once you get the pH to where you want it to be, you add rennet, which is normally about an hour later, and the rennet's just going to coagulate the milk into a coagulum, and then you're going to cut it. And you cut it different sizes depending on what you're trying to make. If you're making making a cheese like a camembert or a brie or a soft cheese, you cut it into big chunks, you know, like maybe 1 or even 2 inch pieces. If you're making one of the cheeses I made was modeled after a Swiss cheese called Gruyere, you're going to cut that curd into the grains the size of rice, really small pieces, because you're trying to get all the moisture out of there because you want that cheese to age for a long time. And then in some cases, you're going to heat the milk. In the case of a camembert, you're not. You're basically going to hoop it right away. But in the case of a Gruyere, you're going to heat it up to about 130 degrees over the next hour. And again, that's the point of that, is to get all the moisture out of there. Then you're going to hoop it, and in some cases, you're going to press it. Cheeses like camembert and blue cheese, you don't press because those are gravity drained. If it's a cheese like a cheddar or a cheese like a Gruyere, you're going to press it with a fair amount of pressure. And then you're going to salt that, which often takes place in a brine bath if it's an aged cheese. And then you're going to age it. Now, there's lots of different cheeses. I'm not sure what your favorite cheese is, but I tend to specialize in hard cheeses that are aged for a long time. So think cloth-bound cheddar cheeses, think Swiss or Gruyere cheeses, Goudas, raclettes, and I also make blue cheeses.
Well, it's fantastic. My wife's from France, so she loves cheeses.
Oh, yeah.
Different cheese for just about every day of the year there. So
and in every region in France it's different too. Of course, we have no food culture here compared to what they have there.
Yeah. Now, you also smoke cheese. Does that help preserve it, or is that just a flavor enhancer?
No, I mean, it doesn't help preserve it, because the process of making cheese itself is actually, particularly with an aged cheese, because you're actually controlling the decay of the cheese when you make it the way I just described, that's your preservation process. The smoking is really for flavoring and for color. And I smoked, I think you're referring to a blog post I did on my website. I don't smoke commercially. I mean, you could, but the cheeses that I made commercially, you know, were sold to really nice restaurants and retail shops. The cheeses I smoke at home, and I'll take a cheddar or I'll take a blue cheese and do a cold smoke to it. Cold smoke meaning I want to keep the temperature down at no higher than 85, but preferably for cheese around 70 degrees, and smoke it for about 2 hours or so. And it just gives it just a tremendous flavor. I think, you know, pretty much everybody loves smoked cheese.
And you wrote a blog post recently about persevering in hard times, particularly about how folks during the Depression got by. Can you give us some pointers from that?
Oh, yeah. Survival tips from the Great Depression. That's right. There was a book I had listened to a number of times called Little Heathens, and that gave me the idea to, like, and that book was set in the 1930s, and she was recalling her childhood of the Depression. And that book really made me think about how a lot of people who, my family included, who survived the Great Depression didn't really know that there were hard times, they had food, and, you know, they still had their chickens, and, you know, they weren't living in the city. They weren't dependent, you know, they weren't invested in the stock market. Their stock market was the livestock market. I mean, they had a cow, you know. So for people like that, there wasn't a Great Depression. So if you can fast forward and extrapolate, there's a good life lesson there for the rest of us. Unfortunately, the world looks very different today. Very few of us live that kind of life. So the real tips that you learn from how you would survive and do well. If there was a cataclysmic depression, what are the things that you would need to have it not really impact you too much? Well, number one, don't have any debt. You know, be debt free. And yeah, I understand that may be easier said than done, but you know, when I wrote a book a year ago called How to Make Money Homesteading, and that book I profiled about 18 other people, and many of them had talked about how they'd used Dave Ramsey's methods and they had gotten out of debt. So whatever it takes, I think, you know, people need to take the steps to not have any debt. Number two, you know, people had simple pleasures. And this is one of the things that we actually enjoy a lot on our farmstead. You know, they take, you know, you walk or take walks or you whittle instead of spending $200 a month on your satellite TV bill and $200 a month, you know, for your phone bill. You know, these are things that people never had to do before. And by the way, those are discretionary expenses. We think that they're necessities that we have to have and we can't live our life without. But really, I mean, if you wanted to, you don't need those things. They're not necessities. Number three, if you know, in terms of a lesson from the Great Depression, people respected food. I mean, you're not just putting food away and knowing how to pressure can and knowing how to preserve food or dehydrate food or whatever, but not wasting food. And also, you know, how to recognize food, how to walk in the woods and recognize a wild edible. And, you know, lamb's quarter. I mean, lamb's quarter is fantastic for you. It's free. It grows everywhere, you know, but most people would not, you know, even think about grabbing a weed like that and eating it, but they'll go to the store and spend a lot of money on bagged spinach from California that's been traveling for 2 weeks. You know, and respect food by, you know, when I lived on the house in Atlanta in suburbia, we had bought that house. It had this beautiful Bradford pear tree in the front yard. You know, the trees that give you these beautiful white flowers for like 2 weeks out of the year in April. You know, and only would we as spoiled Americans breed the fruit out of the tree. So now we have all these trees everywhere where they don't produce any fruit. And then our backyard was full of crepe myrtles, which are pretty flowers in the summer, but they don't produce anything to eat. So, you know, I would have, you know, any landscape have anything, you know, that you can possibly eat. If you got fence lines, you put your grapevines there or your blackberry bushes. You know, plant trees that actually produce real pears and real apples and let them fall on your lawn. That's fine. But, you know, we've gotten so far, you know, away from that kind of thinking that it's really rare. I mean, we stop and look when we see an apple tree or a pear tree. You just never see those things. And, you know, a couple other lessons from the Great Depression or from times gone by is to have some real skills. I mean, you just talked to me about how to make cheese. That's something that people are like, wow, I really want to do that. But it's a very basic thing to do, as is making soap, as is pressure canning foods, as is how to cure bacon, how to cure meats, how to sharpen blades, how to make repairs, how to build things, how to kill a chicken, how to kill a turkey, how to butcher these animals. These are all skills, Mark, that I do all the time, and I didn't do one of these things 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I was doing PowerPoint presentations, and I was sitting in, you know, seat, you know, 10A on an airplane all the time. So you can go out and learn these things. I mean, it was our parents that got us away from these things, and their parents that got them away from these things. But we kind of have to take these things back. And the last thing I guess I would say as a lesson from back then is, you know, we go to the doctor. Sorry for all you out there who are listening who are doctors. I'm not trying to cut into your business, but we go to the doctors way too much and for too many things. I mean, if you have to go to the doctor, if you have a serious condition, then by all means, we need to be going. But, you know, there's medicinal herbs that we can grow. There's tinctures and salves that we can make. We make all these things ourselves. And, you know, there's a lot of things you can do to take care of yourself that we abdicate to professionals.
Great advice. And can you tell the folks where they can find your blog and how do they purchase your books?
Yeah, I mean, I keep a website at selfsufficientman.com. There's no hyphen. It's just selfsufficientman.com. And all my books are either on Audible or on Amazon. They're not, I don't sell them to Barnes & Noble or bookstores, but the print versions, the Kindle version, the Audible version is all on Amazon.
Very cool. Tim, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today and keep up the great work.
Mark, it's really my pleasure. Thank you.
In the days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition. A global empire arises like a phoenix from the ashes of the world that was. The emerging order is unified by a new global currency and a single world religion, which are mandated by an imposed UN treaty. In the interest of unity and peace, a zero-tolerance policy for dissenters is enacted and strictly enforced. Hunted down like common criminals for daring to resist the state, Noah Parker's group will have to rely on faith and wits to endure the powers of darkness, which are quickly consuming the earth. Buy your copy of The Days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition, by best-selling author Mark Goodwin in paperback, Kindle, or audio edition from Amazon.com today.